Zum Ende des Jahres 2024 starten wir mit der Top 3 der meistgehörten Episoden des Criminal Compliance Podcast im Jahr 2024. Platz 3 gibt es heute.
Rosinas on Air, the Criminal Compliance Podcast.
Welcome to the Criminal Compliance Podcast. My name is Christian Zinus, and today we have, as you can hear, another English episode. And it is not that I speak alone. I have wonderful guests here. International guests from London, Maya Lester and Michael O'Kane. Welcome.
Thank you, Christian. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's lovely to have you here on this podcast. Maybe you can introduce yourself and tell our audience what you're doing. And we'll be talking about sanctions. So maybe you can explain a bit what you are doing in this field.
Thank you. My name is Maya Lester, and I'm a barrister in the UK, which means that I am a litigator. I'm a self-employed litigator. And in particular, I specialize in law relating to sanctions, both EU sanctions and UK sanctions. And that includes representing parties in cases before courts or arbitral tribunals, and also giving advice on all aspects of sanctions.
My name is Michael O'Kane. I'm the senior partner of Peters and Peters, which is a law firm based in London. And we specialize in white collar crime, which is why we know you, Christian. We've known you for many years. And the white collar crime space has become a little occupied now by issues relating to sanctions. And that's because, going back a little bit historically, the EU started imposing sanctions on people around allegations of corruption. And so white collar crime lawyers got a little bit involved in that and then built on their sanctions experience. And that's what happened to us. So we've been doing sanctions work in this firm since 2011, the Arab Spring. We picked up clients who were Egyptian and then Libyan, Syrian, and then Zimbabwe. We acted for with Meyer in the court in Luxembourg. Then we've done more cases involving Belarus, Myanmar, and obviously much more recently, Russia, which I know we're going to come on and talk about.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's, yes, we know it's quite long. I know how very well you do in this area and how well known you are. So it's really great that you have the time, take the time to speak to our audience here. Yeah, the Russia sanctions, you mentioned them, are really keeping us busy the last couple of months, and probably also you. But maybe before we dig into the Russia sanctions, we may have a look at a general view. How does the UK sanction regime work, and how is it comparable to the European Union and the US sanctions?
So US sanctions, EU sanctions, and UK sanctions are all broadly similar in the sense that they are all tools for foreign policy goals of different kinds. They all use legal instruments to try to achieve those goals, and those goals can be anything from trying to counter corruption and gross human rights violations, to trying to stop the war in Ukraine, to trying to stop Iran from enriching uranium. So a broad range of different measures. Now, the UK used to be part of the European Union, as we know, and therefore the UK used to do its sanctioning as part of the EU's common foreign and security policy. And now the UK, post-Brexit, has its own sanctions regime. It has its own statutory framework under a piece of legislation called the Sanctions and Anti-Money Laundering Act. But in basic form, it takes the same broad form as EU sanctions, but now in some important respects, it's diverging. So to answer your question about how these different regimes are similar and how they're different, they are, as I've said, all broadly trying to do the same thing. Sometimes all those three sanctions jurisdictions have overlapping foreign policies. Now, at the moment, when it comes to Russia, they are broadly trying to achieve the same goal, very often through membership of the G7. But sometimes foreign policies, of course, diverge. And the Iran nuclear deal is an obvious example of that, where they were all marching hand in hand, and then the US decided to pull out and do something different. They all broadly have sanctions which follow a familiar theme. So first of all, they all draw up lists of people and companies who are subject to financial sanctions, that is, restrictions on holding and having access to funds and economic resources, and sometimes travel restrictions. And then they all impose a very wide variety of different non-targeted sanctions, so sanctions that apply across the board within their jurisdiction, which can be anything from trade restrictions, export controls, sometimes the same and sometimes different from each other. They also all impose criminal and civil penalties for breach of sanctions. They all have systems for providing exceptions and special permissions and licenses. They do all those things a bit differently, and we might come on to that. For example, the licensing systems of asking for permission are a bit different across the different jurisdictions. The degree to which sanctions are enforced are different, and the degree to which guidance is given by the authorities is a bit different, but they are broadly doing similar things.
Okay, super, thank you. When and where do the UK sanctions apply?
So, as with most issues around sanctions, there's a kind of simple answer to that, and there's a more complicated answer. But so, the simple answer is with targeted financial sanctions. Myers mentioned having people on lists. So this is where what you're trying to do is to freeze a person's assets, stop them from traveling, all that kind of thing. Those sanctions apply immediately. I mean, that's the whole point of them. I mean, if we were to give people advance notice of we're going to sanction you in 2 weeks' time, then there would be the risk that they would move their capital, move their assets, etc., or try to. And there's been some evidence of people having a little bit of advance notice and trying to do that in the past. That's one of the problems with the EU sanctions, because you've got to get 27 member states to agree. Quite a lot of what the EU does is already sort of forewarned. There's lots of chat about it. There's lots of leaks that go on. So in terms of the sort of broader measures that they're considering taking, often that is signposted sometimes months in advance. As far as the UK is concerned, obviously they apply immediately on these targeted financial sanctions. They apply not just to the people who are on the lists, but they apply to any assets, companies, trusts that they own or control, and we may talk a little bit about that because it's an interesting subject and causes a lot of confusion. They apply, as I say, they apply immediately, and they also apply to third parties, banks or people who are dealing with the assets in some way, where they are in the United Kingdom, on the territory of the United Kingdom, or for UK nationals, anywhere in the world. So it's a really interesting legal jurisdictional concept, which is were not that common in terms of UK law, certainly UK criminal law. In most cases, if you're a UK national and you go abroad, you commit a crime, you're not liable for that in the United Kingdom. But in sanctions, wherever you are in the world, as long as you're a UK passport holder, if you engage in conduct that breaches UK sanctions, you are liable for that in the United Kingdom. One other thing just to say in relation to that, because it's important from a practical perspective, UK sanctions apply in these sort of overseas territories, Jersey, Guernsey, BVI, Cayman Islands, places like that. And that is particularly important because obviously for some of those jurisdictions, that's where an awful lot of wealth is maintained for tax reasons. And so when sanctions have been applied, for example, in the Russia context, an awful lot of wealth that the UK government talks about being frozen is frozen in those particular jurisdictions.
Just one question. You mentioned that when the UK was in the European Union, we had the same regime. Now we have a different regime. How is it with, for example, judgments of the European Court of Justice? Are they still applicable for the time before or not?
I mean, the simple answer to that is no, they're not. And courts in the UK can no longer refer questions to the European Court of Justice as they did as member states. The courts, however, in the UK who have started to give judgments relating to sanctions issues, UK sanctions issues, have had quite careful regard to EU judgments and EU sanctions. And it has been an important aspect of what the UK courts have said so far, that they regard UK sanctions as being born out of EU sanctions, reflecting them, and therefore they have, of course, continued relevance, but they are not binding in the UK.
Okay, thank you. Interesting. And how is non-compliance with UK sanctions regimes enforced or sanctioned?
Well, that is a really interesting question. So first of all, again, unlike other areas, apart from perhaps money laundering, there are enormous obligations now on third parties in the UK to report. They have to, banks have to report if they're holding assets or if they have reasonable grounds to suspect that they're holding assets. Professionals, whether they set up trusts or they act as professional trustees, law firms, professional service firms, they all have to report to OFSI, which is an agency that sits within the UK Treasury. So OFSI, since, if we're talking about Russia, since the end of February 2022, has been building up a very, very significant database on all the various assets that are owned or thought to be owned by sanctioned individuals within the UK or within those territories. The reason for that being important from an enforcement perspective is that a failure to report is a criminal offence, and there are duties not just to report at the beginning, but periodic reporting obligations. There are then obligations to report if there's been a breach, and there have been hundreds of reported breaches. You would think that would lead to maybe not hundreds of cases, but tens of cases. But so far, in the Russian context, we're over 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine, there has yet to be any OFSI enforcement action, either civil fine or warning or prohibition or publication, in relation to anybody for breaching those measures. And we believe, according to recent evidence before Parliament, there's been about 470 or 472 breaches of the Russia sanctions so far. And OFSI has said they will be announcing some fines early in 2024. And we sit here now on the 18th of June? And at the moment, there has been no such announcement. The other thing I would say, though, is for those interested in criminal enforcement, there has been, up until very recently, there had never been a criminal case brought for a sanctions breach. The first of such cases has now been brought, and it's been brought against a former Russian public official called Dmitry Ovsyannikov. He has been charged, along with his wife and his brother, for alleged sanctions breaches relating to payment largely for personal expenses that he was incurring when he came to the United Kingdom in 2023. So it'll be interesting to see how that case plays out. The only other case in the UK where there was an attempt at criminal enforcement involved a very famous oligarch called Michael Friedman. Friedman had an £80 million house in Highgate. It was raided by 50 officers from the National Crime Agency. Friedman was arrested, alleged sanctions breaches. Anyway, cutting a long story short, he was successful in bringing a legal challenge against that. The warrants that were used were determined to be unlawful. His legal costs were paid, and the case against him was dropped. So that's not been a very auspicious start to sanctions enforcement by the National Crime Agency.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned sanctioning, and the sanctions apply if assets can be determined to a certain person. So how do you determine if an entity asset is owned or controlled by a sanctioned person? How do you do that?
Sanctions lists differ in how they determine this question. As I've said, the US, the EU, and the UK all draw up lists of targets of financial sanctions. The way the US does this is to say that if you are owned more than 50% by somebody who is a US SDN, someone on the US sanctions list, then financial sanctions apply to you, your company also. The EU and the UK do it differently. They say that if a company is owned or controlled by somebody on a sanctions list, by a designated person, then all the same financial sanctions restrictions apply to those companies owned or controlled by people on the list. Now, the EU and the UK have different tests, slightly different tests, for how one determines whether a company is owned or controlled by a designated person. But this is a crucially important issue because the companies owned or controlled by designated persons are not named, not added themselves to the list. And that means for those trying to comply with financial sanctions, for example, counterparties to contracts, people wondering whether they can make payments to designated persons, you cannot simply screen the list in order to know who sanctions apply to. You have to go through a process of working out which companies are owned or controlled by designated persons. Now, in the EU, the test is whether a designated person, so that's someone on the list, is able to and effectively asserts a decisive influence over the conduct of the entity in question. And that is determined by looking at a series of factors and trying to make that determination in the round. That's something which is determined by national competent authorities of EU member states. And in some cases, different member states have reached different views on whether an entity is owned or controlled by the same designated person. So there's no uniformity across the European Union on that issue. The UK has a different, slightly different test, which is whether, so a designated person controls a company, if it is reasonable to expect that that person would, if he chose, be able to achieve the result that the affairs of the company are conducted in accordance with his wishes, having regard to all the circumstances, in most cases, in significant respects, by whatever means, directly or indirectly. Now, what that test means, and it's a very broad test, has been the subject of a lot of disagreement, including disagreement between different courts in the United Kingdom. Why is it a problematic or difficult test to apply? Well, one problematic feature is that because President Putin is sanctioned in Russia and because a number of government ministers are sanctioned, that has created the obvious question of, does that mean that since President Putin could potentially control all companies in Russia, does that really mean that all companies in Russia are to be regarded as being sanctioned? Or is the test something rather narrower than that? Does the test refer to some sort of broad political control? Does it refer to some much more specific existing influence of a designated person? And therefore, this has led to a great deal of uncertainty among the legal community and those trying to comply with sanctions. The good news is that to some extent, this issue may be resolved by a case going to the Supreme Court shortly this year, a case called Boris Mintz. But it has so far been the subject of guidance by the government and disagreement between different courts.
Okay, understood. So you already mentioned that there are some reporting obligation for lawyers. On a broader sense, how do these sanctions impact the London legal market? I understand the London legal market was very well known for also representing or having huge cases of Russian oligarchs before the London courts. So I guess this will be difficult now. So how does it work, and how, which impact do these sanctions have on the London and UK legal market?
That is a really good question. And it's a slightly controversial question, because when Putin decided to invade Ukraine, obviously there was a huge reaction to that in the international community. Lawyers are obviously swim in the waters of rules and regulations, and there was a significant reaction by many lawyers to what Russia had done and the lawfulness of what Russia had done. And it did force a number of them to take what I would describe as a sort of moral position. Many of those firms were international law firms. Many of those firms had Moscow offices, and they'd had those Moscow offices for decades, all the way through Putin's tenure, all the way through Yukos and Khodorkovsky, all the way through the Skripal case or Navalny, all the way through the annexation of Crimea. And they'd maintained those offices, and many of them had acted for Russian state-owned companies, such as the large energy companies owning, no doubt, tens of millions of dollars of revenue from legal fees. But as soon as Russia invaded Ukraine, everyone threw their hands in the air, and it then became objectionable by many of those for any law firm to be acting for any party that was Russian, let alone a party that was Russian and was sanctioned. So there was only a small number of law firms that were left, including ours. Most of those have one thing in common, which is that we have a spinal cord, which is criminal law. We're criminal lawyers. And criminal lawyers should understand where they sit in the system, which is that if you believe in the rule of law, then you believe that everybody whose rights are infringed by the state is entitled to a legal defense. And that's the view we took in this firm, and we were criticized for it, criticized in Parliament, in fact, in the early days, unjustly, in my view. The atmosphere has calmed down quite a lot since then. And the opprobrium that was thrown around has, I think, lessened to a large degree. But it's definitely had what I would describe as sort of a chilling effect, because obviously dealing with Russia has practical difficulties. There are difficulties in getting paid. There are difficulties in being insured. And that has a knock-on effect on the commercial litigation cases. So if you look at the number of Russian cases in the London courts, you're right, Christian, over the years, it's been the predominant jurisdiction for litigating Russian cases. But that now is going down. My prediction is that that might go back up again. It's certainly either in the commercial courts or a combination of the commercial courts and the arbitration courts, because I think there will be a lot of litigation coming out of Russia's actions in Ukraine and the impact that that's having on lots of companies. You can see Russia now, for example, is seeking to take companies that are Western-owned, that are currently in Russia. We've seen this with Danone. We've seen it with Carlsberg. I suspect we're going to see this with hundreds and hundreds of other companies, and that will give rise to countless claims, which will be litigated in the West, with London being a prime beneficiary of.
Very interesting. And specifically for sanctions persons, how is legal advice possible, and how can you get your fees paid, for example? How does it work?
So giving legal advice to designated people is not a sanctions breach. The thing that is potentially difficult because of the financial restrictions on dealing with the funds of a designated person is being paid for giving legal advice. And all the main sanctions jurisdictions, the US, the EU and the UK, all have a system of licensing to permit lawyers to be paid what the governments regard as reasonable legal fees. Some have specific licenses requiring lawyers to apply every time they want to do legal work. Others, like the US and now the UK, in some cases have a general license permitting work to take place across the board. There are, however, some particular Russia-related restrictions on what kind of legal advice can be given. The UK has prohibited some legal advisory services, though the government had to issue a general license making clear that compliance advice, in other words, advice on how to comply with sanctions, was permitted. The EU has prohibited legal advisory services to Russian companies. But as long as those restrictions are navigated, providing legal advice for sanctioned people and entities is still possible. As Michael has said, it has become the domain of a more restricted number of people. But I think it's also important to point out that there are still many cases, both in arbitral tribunals and in the courts, where Russian parties, both sanctioned and not sanctioned, are litigating. And the overall approach of the judiciary, in my view, has been to try to keep those cases going, but to allow adjournments and periods of time and practical solutions, which often involve delay, to try to make sure that sanctions don't derail cases unless they really have.
Okay, understood. You mentioned court cases. What cases have come before the court so far?
In relation to de-designation challenges, there have been very few. The leading case is a case that we are involved in, and that is a case of an individual called Eugene Schwidler. And Mr. Schwidler was not Russian. He has never been Russian. He left the former Soviet Union in 1989. He got US citizenship in 1994, British citizenship in 2010. And he has been sanctioned on two grounds. First is association with Roman Abramovich, because you can be sanctioned for being associated with somebody who is a designated person. In this context, association means sort of business colleague or a friend. And he's also sanctioned for having been a non-executive director of a FTSE 100 company called Evraz. Now, Evraz had 9 directors. Only 3 of those directors were sanctioned, and all 3 of those were of what I would describe Russian heritage. Anyway, we brought a challenge against his designation. The impact on him was very severe and on his family. He had children in school. They were thrown out of school. He had to leave the country. The children had to leave the country. They've been separated from their mother, who has remained here. It's had a devastating impact on his business interests. Most of his assets were held through the BVI, so all sanctioned. And he is not somebody who has been heavily involved in business in Russia, and he is somebody who has spoken out against Russia's actions in Ukraine. So we said that the sanctions on him did not achieve their objective, they're not rational, and they're certainly not proportionate. But in the High Court, we lost. And the High Court judgment was, in essence, that, yes, his rights were infringed, but the objective sought by the Foreign Office in bringing sanctions outweighed those rights, and that the Foreign Office ought to be given very significant discretion when it comes to making decisions around sanctioning people as it's a matter of foreign policy. So the courts are reluctant to step into decision-making around foreign policy by the British government. That judgment was largely upheld in the Court of Appeal, with some sort of nuance around the test for proportionality. The Court of Appeal said pretty much the same thing. We've been granted leave to go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court seems to want to get this case on this year. So we expect, subject to diary commitments, that we will be in the Supreme Court before the end of the year, and hopefully we will then have judgment by February, March, or April of next year. And that will then determine and set the basis for what the appropriate test should be and how these cases ought to be dealt with going forward.
Sounds like a quite significant case. Very interesting.
So what Michael has described about de-designations arises because all of the people on sanctions lists have the right to bring a case saying, I shouldn't be on this list. And the UK cases about the UK list follow a very rich heritage of EU cases on the same subject, which is how I became involved in sanctions cases. People on EU sanctions lists saying I shouldn't be on this list. And in the case of Russia sanctions in particular, the criteria on which someone can be listed are so very wide, the net has been cast very broadly, that has given rise to a lot of people saying I shouldn't be on this sanctions list, both in the EU and the UK. So that's the what we call the delisting or the de-designation cases. However, there's an awful lot of litigation about sanctions in the UK courts and indeed the courts of EU member states, which is not about people on sanctions lists, but is about the more commercial impact that sanctions have on transactions, on contractual situations. And there have been now a very large number of different cases which relate to issues like, do these very broad sanctions prohibitions mean that I cannot perform my contract? When is a contract frustrated by sanctions? When does a contract become illegal to perform as a result of sanctions? What happens if that illegality is someone else's sanction system? In other words, if you can't perform because you would breach US sanctions, when would that be a good defense if you are not a US person? Interpretation of sanctions clauses. What is the impact of a party becoming sanctioned in the course of litigation and so on? You can imagine very diverse set of circumstances, all of which have now given rise to judgments in the courts of the UK.
Yeah, that's a really interesting field, and I think we need judgments to clarify at least so that we have ways to advise our clients properly. If listeners who follow the EU sanctions would like to contact you, and under which circumstances would they have to seek your advice, for example?
Well, we advise on all aspects of sanctions, UK and EU sanctions. this broadly covers companies and individuals who really want to know how to comply with sanctions, is something that they're currently doing or hoping to do at risk of sanctions breach, and what are the enforcement risks, what should they do in a great many different practical situations. I think one common aspect of advising on sanctions is overlapping different sanctions jurisdictions coming into play. So often people's questions will be, is there a sufficient nexus to the UK to engage UK sanctions? What if UK sanctions are different from or overlapping with EU and US and other sanctions jurisdictions? So it's one of the attractive aspects of this area of work for me is its international nature, as this podcast, you know, illustrates. Different sanctions jurisdictions are often relevant to different areas of advisory work.
I would agree with all of that. It's not just acting for people who are sanctioned and doing de-designation challenges or helping them to manage dealing with their assets in a way that's lawful. As Maya says, it's really trying to advise mostly corporate clients about navigating the different jurisdictional tensions that take place. One of the areas that we've been particularly involved in is dealing with these British territories, so many Guernsey, Jersey, the BVI, Cayman Islands. Those are fertile jurisdictions for trusts, complex trust structures. And if you've got perhaps one person in a family who's been sanctioned, that person might be a beneficiary, there might be a protector, there might even be a trustee. What's the impact on the trust structures? It gives rise to all sorts of really quite challenging, complicated legal issues. So we've been doing a lot of that work as well.
Okay, if our audience would like to find additional information on sanctions, what would you suggest? I think you have a wonderful homepage going on this topic. Maybe you can elaborate a bit more in detail on this.
So Michael and I both jointly have a website called globalsanctions.co.uk, which we set up a number of years ago to give practical legal advice on sanctions law. We've tried to make it global in its reach, thanks to you, has information on Germany, and there are many other sanctions jurisdictions covered. The reason we set that up was because sanctions is such a fast-moving area that this is an area of law where there are updates sometimes, several times a day, changes in sanctions legislation around the world, and we wanted to make that information much more transparent. One helpful aspect of the recent sanctions really coming into the global spotlight is that governments have started producing a lot more guidance on sanctions than they used to, particularly the European Commission, which used to produce very little guidance on sanctions, now has quite a lot. And therefore, government websites are another useful source of sanctions information. And of course, law firms like yours have podcasts like this, but also a lot of helpful information coming out of law firms summarizing developments in the world of sanctions. But we would obviously recommend globalsanctions.co.uk as we hope the most comprehensive and up-to-date source.
Just to follow on from what Maya said, what we've tried to do is ensure that anybody who subscribes to Global Sanctions, you can subscribe for free. You will get into your inbox every day or as often as you want it, all sanctions stories that will be of some relevance. So we try to cover everything that has happened on a particular day in the world of sanctions, whatever it might be. On top of that, we have a repository of judgments, both EU judgments, UK judgments, US judgments, and we have all of the relevant legislation from all of the key jurisdictions set out in a very sort of helpful format so that you can find it quite easily. We have a sanctions target search facility. So if you want to, you're doing business with somebody, or you're trying to advise somebody and you do a conflict check and you think, oh, this person, you can search and see whether that person has been subject to sanctions. And as Maya says, you can look at all the guidance and it's very, very easily searchable. So the people who subscribe to it, we have thousands of subscribers, are practicing lawyers in law firms, academics and students, but also government. So we have subscribers from OFAC, from the European Commission, from the European Council, from OFSI, from the Foreign Office, from the foreign offices of many, many, many countries. And we are often told when we bump into people like that from who are engaged in sanctions policy that they find it to be an extremely, extremely useful sort of research tool.
Yeah, that's also my opinion. I can highly recommend it. And of course, we will put it in a link in the show notes so that everybody can double check it also. And if our audience has questions, I will also put your contact details in the show notes so that you can contact Maya and Michael directly if you like. If you'd like to contact me, as always, info@rosinus-on-air.com. Thank you very much for being on this podcast. It was such a pleasure having you here. Thank you for taking time. Thank you for these helpful insights. It was a great pleasure listening to you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Christian, for the opportunity.
And thank you very much for having us. It was a pleasure.
Rosinus on Air, the Criminal Compliance Podcast. The podcast only provides a general overview of legal issues and, of course, does not replace legal advice on specific issues in individual cases. If you have any questions, please contact a trusted lawyer or, of course, feel free to get in touch with us. www.rosinusonair.com or at www.rosinuspartner.com.